We have just heard Ralph Martiri, director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, arguing that the way to improve school funding, at least in Illinois, and gain more equity for students, is to restructure the current tax system so that the state can increase the percentage of money it contributes to the schools and raise the foundation level of state support for individual students. He also wants, and this would apply to every state, to require the federal government to fund the various mandates they impose on education, as, for example, their requirements for special education. But there is another point of view, argued by people who want government to get out of education. They argue that we have tried government funding of education and that it doesn't work. They say schools are getting more and more money and a greater percentage of the state's budget, and yet the students in these schools are becoming less and less well-educated while they cost the state more and more money, at this point eating up about 35% of state funds. They argue that privatizing schools and creating a free market system would lead to a better, less costly, or more efficient and more equitable education. Our next guest on our program is an expert on arguments for and against privatizing education and on the economics of paying for such systems. After taking early retirement from Stanford University, Henry M. Levin went to Columbia University, where he is currently director of an institute he began, the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education. He is also co-director of the Center for Benefit Cost Studies in Education. Thank you for agreeing to be a guest on our program, Professor Levin. Before I start firing questions at you, can you tell us a little about yourself and your work?
Yes. I'm an economist. I have a PhD in economics, and I've specialized in the economics of human resources and especially education. This field has many dimensions, but one of the central ones is trying to improve efficiency in the use of resources in producing education, looking at investment returns to human capital for particular kinds of education, and financing of education and its consequences.
Well, I can certainly see that you're exactly the right person to have chosen for today. Let me just stop for a second. Jason, there's a lot of static on his input. Is there any way of getting rid of that? What about calling him back? Would that make a difference? Okay. Well, can you tell us something about the range of models we have for privatizing the funding of our schools?
Yes. There are two basic models. The one that's probably best known is the educational voucher. And the educational voucher arrangement is one in which the government would pay for education because of its importance in creating a democratic society and preparing people for democratic institutions to work together and, of course, to ascertain that everyone can participate in education. At the very least, the funding shouldn't be an obstacle. But where it differs is the assumption that the government, while funding education, should not be producing directly education. Instead, the production would go to the marketplace. And in the marketplace, schools would compete for students. They would receive a voucher for each student that they could redeem with the treasury of the state to get the funding. There would be some restrictions on them because, obviously, to meet the requirements of preparing people for a democratic society, they would have to do some things in terms of their curriculum, perhaps in terms of specific subjects, in terms perhaps of particular approaches that they use to ensure that people are prepared to be citizens, prepared to work in the economy and to understand economic institutions and also social institutions. But beyond that, any school could emerge meeting the requirements to be approved, to be eligible, to receive a voucher, and then they would compete for students. And so the argument of the voucher advocates is that this would be a more efficient way for providing education in a number of ways, the first being to match students and to match family preferences more closely to what individual schools do, and the second, because of the competition in the marketplace for students. So the incentive to offer good programs and to compete effectively and to abandon things that aren't working where there's a deficiency of student demand and to move in the direction where there seems to be a very strong student demand. So that's the voucher plan.
Is that the major major model, or are there other models?
Well, there are other models, but it's kind of, let's call it the major conceptual model, because it really covers education at all levels. And when I compare it with the other model, the other main model, you'll see quite a large difference. I should also add that we do have voucher programs in Milwaukee. We've had one in Milwaukee since 1990, so this is perhaps the 21st year. We've had one in Cleveland, I believe, since 1995, so that would be 16 years. We've had one in Washington, D.C. for 3 years, and it has, I think, one additional year to go before it will be passing on. That was an experimental program, and perhaps the results didn't justify the continuing of the program, although that's very controversial among the advocates and the detractors. So we've had the voucher programs, and where you see more of it, where you see it expanding, actually, is in special education. There are at least five or six states that now offer special education vouchers that parents can take anywhere they want within the limits of the size of the voucher to get their children education. Would you like me to mention the alternative?
Yes.
The alternative is what is called a tuition tax credit. And the tuition tax credit basically provides a write-off at the bottom of the tax return. That's why it's a credit for either some portion of tuition or some maximum amount that you can obtain by sending a child to a private school. There is at least one state that has a tuition tax deduction in which you can treat it as a deduction as you treat your mortgage interest and other deductibles on the state tax. But the tuition tax credit is more common because, you know, at the end of the year, so to speak, for each child in a private school, you get a certain amount directly off the tax burden that you would otherwise owe. Now, why are they so different, and why do people see them as different? Well, for one reason, you still have a goal of trying to get competition, and that argument is made even for tuition tax credits, saying that now you now introduce people into the marketplace. But the tuition tax credit is preferred by libertarians and really people with strongly conservative political views, because it's just a change in the tax code. It doesn't get into education per se, whereas the voucher plan does require that schools be eligible, that schools be approved by meeting certain kinds of standards in order to be eligible for the voucher. And so libertarians and other conservatives don't like the notion that the government can set standards for private schools. They want private schools to have complete autonomy.
But would this tax credit provide enough money?
Well, the tax credit normally does not cover all of tuition by any means, but it certainly reduces the private cost. And, you know, when you reduce the cost or the price of any particular good or service, you get a larger demand for it.
What in terms of vouchers, because you were saying that would simply be public funding of the vouchers, but what about private corporations? I know Andrew Coulson mentioned something about a system in Florida. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. That actually goes something like a tuition tax credit, only it's the funder who is able to deduct that from the tax bill. And so that's why, in that particular case, businesses can donate money to a fund, and then that's tax deductible for them, and the fund can be used to pay tuition for students.
How effective is something like that?
I don't think that any study has been done, and the question is effective in what respect? Effective in terms of producing better education, effective in helping poor children get access to private schools. It's not clear what the goal is other than making it more nearly possible for children to go to private schools.
Well, now I know that, and in your book, Your Consequences, well, Privatizing Educational Choice, Consequences for Parents, Schools, and Public Policy, you also point to different models of schools, not just, say, charter schools or private schools, but schools that are for profit. And what you make a point of is that you say there are very few for-profit models existing in the history of our country. Can you elaborate on this?
Yes. One of the interesting aspects of the private school is that in the United States, always three-quarters or more of the students have been in religiously affiliated schools, so that the purpose of these schools has been more to deal with values and religious principles and things of that sort than to make money for founders. Now, even of the other 25%, most of those, the vast majority of those, are not for profit. So if you look around, for example, in Illinois and in the Urbana-Champaign area or in the Chicago area, if you look historically, almost none of the private or independent schools were for profit. But they were run by different organizations. They were not for profit. So the history of private schools in the U.S. has been really a not-for-profit phenomenon. In the last decade and a half or so, there's been interest in saying, well, let's start a for-profit organization, and then we'll offer to contract with charter school boards, for example, to run their schools. And so that's been where the expansion has been. And these organizations are called educational management organizations. Now, the most, the best known of these organizations has been Edison Schools. And Edison Schools got a lot of press because of its very strong ambitions. What is most interesting is that as a business model, there are very few of these companies that are actually making profits on running schools. And in some cases, they're making profits because they get into the real estate business and then lease back the real estate to the charter school, and that's where they're making their money. There's one company that's under investigation right now, one of the larger ones, that has been charged with that. So it's a complicated phenomenon, but one of the problems is that these companies have to do a lot of marketing to get customers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The normal public schools don't have to do marketing. Even if they allow choice within their school district, they don't have to market so that they save certain costs. There are other issues that surround them financially, too, and it's noteworthy to note that Edison Schools had about 130 schools if we go back, let's say 8 years. I think that they're down to about one-third of that number now. And they've gone private. They were a publicly held firm. The stock went up to about $39 and then went down below a dollar so that they were delisted, and then they were sold out privately. But over that course, they lost $650 million, and that's not good for a for-profit firm.
Well, here's what my question, because I know one of the criticisms is that in public education you have these huge bureaucracies. You know, particularly in New York, they're always complaining about the large, what do they call it, Livingston Street, where the education, the Department of Education is. And in Illinois, they talk about the, well, we're always in our district having complaints about how much the Mellon Building in Champaign or the district offices in Urbana cost. So when you have a private company step in, supposedly they're saving all this money for administration.
Mm-hmm.
Is you're saying that that doesn't happen?
Well, we don't have any evidence that it happens. Edison was spending far more per student for its executives, for its lawyers, for its executive headquarters, its accountants. These people are very high priced. And they have more of them relative to the numbers of clients. And so this was another problem that Edison had. It couldn't get its central office expenditures down to a level where it could be profitable.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, but by the way, this is not to say that public schools are perfectly efficient by any means, but it's all relative. And we've now tried a number of different approaches, you know, with the private sector, and we don't have any evidence that the private sector is more efficient, or even we don't have any evidence that the private sector gets better results per dollar.
Well, now, you mentioned Milwaukee and Cleveland. How have those examples, models been going?
Okay. The original Milwaukee model did not allow religious schools to participate. So there wasn't much of a market. Obviously, if 80% of the kids are in religiously affiliated schools and you cut that off, you don't have a lot of competition. Starting in 97, 98, though, the religious schools were allowed. The state courts in Wisconsin, approved the use of funds going to religious schools. Obviously, there was a state constitutional issue, and there's also a federal constitutional issue, but the U.S. Supreme Court said it wasn't going to rule on this case, just leave it alone. And so they have had religious schools participating, and quite a few. I mean, they're up at about 140 schools participating in the voucher market with well over 20,000 students now in Milwaukee. The last 3 years, they have had a very, very rigorous evaluation done with meeting all of the statistical requirements so that you can adjust for the caliber of the students and looking to see which group of schools does better. And there's virtually no difference between the Milwaukee public schools for similar students and the voucher schools. And that's been true now for the evaluations for the last 3 years. They've also balanced the evaluation team so that there are advocates of vouchers on the evaluation team, and there are others who have been less optimistic about them, but both sides with good evaluation skills. But even politically, because this is, as you know, such an emotional issue, an ideological issue, what they've tried to do is to balance those who have written in the past raising questions about vouchers versus those who have been very strongly in favor of vouchers on the same evaluation team.
Uh-huh. My other question then would be, what about international models? In our first program, Chile and the Netherlands were brought up on our program.
Yes. Well, let's talk about both of those. Chile is very interesting because it has had a voucher plan since 1980. And as far as we know, it's the only national and universal voucher plan. It's an interesting plan, and it seems to have worked reasonably well. The state has helped out a lot by helping all of the schools that have gotten poor results. So the state has actually intervened directly, even with private schools, and there were many private schools that were not getting good results, and those results have improved a little bit. But there are some issues surrounding the Chilean plan. The first thing you should know is that the Chilean plan probably has more regulations than any state has for its public schools. So it isn't just schools in the marketplace doing their thing. There is a required curriculum. There is required testing at a national level. There are requirements in terms of the funding beyond the voucher. There are restrictions to schools charging tuition or how any additional fees would be allocated. There are a whole range of restrictions. I'll say more about the Dutch plan in a moment because that's also true of the Dutch plan. But if you were to ask, is it effective? It's effective in the sense of freedom of choice. Parents, particularly in the urban areas, have large freedom of choice. In the rural areas, no, because they're too sparse, so there's usually only a public school there. No private schools have come in to compete with the public school because there aren't enough students. And in about a quarter of the municipalities in Chile, there is no competition. The problems that have arisen are twofold. One is that the schools now are more segregated than they've been before by socioeconomic status and income, so that you're seeing poor students in certain schools and left in the public schools, and the students from better-off backgrounds are in schools with children like themselves. The other one is this, that if you ask, well, but has it been effective? Has it really raised achievement relative to what it would have been in a public school system? Chile is now very much a middle-income country. It's been very successful economically. But its test scores on international comparisons are actually lower than comparable countries with comparable levels of income. So the answer is that there's been no obvious impact of the voucher in raising all boats, you know, and making a better system so that everyone does better. Now, one of the answers is that people may not choose schools according to test scores. And the test scores are the currency of these international comparisons. They may choose them for other reasons. They may choose them for religious reasons. They may choose them because they like the style of the school and the pedagogy of the school. So you have to keep that in mind when you ask, is it succeeding? Is it working? Okay?
Well, also, since the emphasis is on funding, the money is still coming from the government?
Yes.
And
parents can add to the voucher, but there are restrictions on how much, and there are also restrictions on what can be done with that funding.
And then the question is it more efficient? In other words, do they have a lower cost per student than, say, the system we have here currently?
Well, you wouldn't want to compare them with the states because we're a much wealthier country, and we have much more extensive programs. You know, the U.S. is one of the few countries in the world that has sports programs, that has co-curricular, extracurricular activities. We have one of the most extensive among all countries special education programs, and that's very expensive. We bus, because of the huge expanses of land, we bus about 60% of our students in the U.S. Busing is largely unknown in other countries. So you can't really compare what we're spending in the U.S. directly with what's being spent in other countries unless you make adjustments. And you also want to make adjustments for the more costly education that we have to provide for those coming from immigrant backgrounds, low-income backgrounds. I mentioned already special education, which can be enormously expensive for moderate and severely disabled children. Those are commitments
actually, you're bringing all that up makes it, I think, clear to our viewer, to our listeners, about all the elements of what's involved in school funding and what your choices are, what compromises need to be made if you're going to decrease the amount of money that goes to education. We probably don't have that much time to go into the Netherlands, but if you could do a brief description.
Sure. Well, the Netherlands is very interesting because the entire country provides freedom of choice. Any one of us could start a school in the Netherlands as long as you adhere to their regulations, and the regulations are extensive. There are personnel requirements in terms of qualifications. There are class size requirements. They have a national testing system. They have a national curriculum system. So what's interesting, again, is that there's more regulation in the Netherlands than in any state in the U.S., even though they have a freedom of choice system. Any of us can start a school. We're guaranteed to get government funding. If we meet those regulations, we can compete for students and so on. So it's a very interesting system. It was started, by the way, because of the conflict between the Protestant and Catholic churches in the Netherlands. So it was originally started to solve the problem of funding schools, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or whatever. And what's interesting today is even though most two-thirds of the students do go to either Catholic or Protestant schools, one-third to schools that are not affiliated. Religion as an issue has declined in the Netherlands. So although the schools are nominally Catholic and Protestant, they're much less overtly Catholic than Catholic schools in the U.S. or Protestant relative to, let's say, Episcopal or Lutheran schools in the U.S.
Well, to switch back to the United States, it seems as though you're saying that these different options, mainly what they give is more choice to the family, as opposed to being either more efficient or more economical. And there's lots of controversy from right now about vouchers and the effect they have on public schools. Do you think that they do affect public schools?
We don't have a lot of evidence on their effects on public schools. I mean, one argument that could be made, let's say in Milwaukee, is that the results for all schools have arisen with this competition. That is, the public schools have to compete with the private schools, and although there's no difference, for example, in achievement between the two, that both groups of schools are doing better because of the competition. When we compare the schools in Milwaukee with schools in other urban areas in the state of Wisconsin, we don't find evidence to support that. Perhaps that's been the biggest surprise, that market competition doesn't seem to have changed at least the test scores for any given group of students. What it has done is it's provided more options. It's provided choices.
Well, you know, what you also have written is that even with the enormous increase in privatization, at least 75% of our students will still be supported through public schools and public funds. And given the small number of students that are involved in privatization, why do you think there's so much emphasis on going this route currently?
Yeah, no, I have to correct that. About 90% of our students are in public schools.
Ah.
And around 10% are in private schools. And that's come down in the middle 60s. It was about 15%. And there have been some changes, of course, within the private school sector as well. About 75% of private school students were in Catholic schools if we go back to the middle 60s, and now it's slightly less than half.
So why do you think there is such a push? Or is it that this idea of choice is what's guiding everything?
Well, I think that the idea of choice is a very powerful idea, and it's not necessarily public versus private. One of the concerns of private schools, and particularly Catholic schools in certain urban areas, is that the charter schools, which are public schools, are kinds of issues. That is, the Catholic schools have to charge tuition, and there, many of their families then say, well, I can get as good an education in another school. I will still choose, but I'll choose a charter school. So there are a lot of interesting facets to this. Still, by the way, for-profit schools have not made a lot of headway in the U.S. Most of the schools are, as I've mentioned, are religious or are still not-for-profit. The real upper-end private schools are virtually all not-for-profit, the so-called exclusive or elite independent schools.
We won't have time to discuss this next point, but I was interested to see that in your book, you thought that the place that privatization and vouchers would be most appropriate and effective was in post-compulsory school attendance, in other words, after high school. And it would be nice to pursue that in another program. Right now, I think we're going to just have to end, and I'll ask you, I'll thank you for coming to help us examine this issue pretty objectively. But I also want to know, what do you think a concerned citizen should do?
Well, a concerned citizen obviously has certain preferences. People usually are not neutral about public versus private in education. So I think that a concerned citizen should mainly be a good democratic citizen. If the citizen does favor private schools because the choice seems to be greater there, then that citizen ought to also be concerned that the private school sector is doing a good job in terms of equity, fairness, and access to people who are of lower socioeconomic background, or who are immigrants, or not English-speaking, at least that's not their first language. And in the private schools, in the public schools, I would say the same thing, that parents ought to be concerned both with the quality of the school as well as making sure that the schools are also preparing us for citizenship, to work together, to share productive economic opportunities together, and so on.
My last question then would be, do you have a website on which our listeners could find out more information about this topic?
Yes, we do. It's www.nancy, C as in Charles, S as in Sam, T as in Peter, E as in Edward, NCSPE, National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education, and we are .org, O-R-G.
Well, thank you very much for a really interesting and informative discussion.
Okay, well, thank you so much for inquiring about this.
We have just heard Ralph Martiri, Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, arguing that the way to improve school funding, at least in Illinois, and gain more equity for students, is to restructure the current tax system so that the state can increase the percentage of money it contributes to the schools and raise the foundation level of state support for individual students. He also wants, and this would apply to every state, to require the federal government to fund the various mandates they impose on education, as, for example, their requirements for special education. Okay. And gain more equity for students is to I need to read the whole sentence, okay? We have just heard Ralph Martiri, Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, arguing that the way to improve school funding, at least in Illinois, and gain more equity for students, is to restructure the current tax system so that the state can increase the percentage of money it contributes to the schools and raise the foundation level of state support for individual students. He also wants, and this would apply to every state, to require the federal government to fund the various mandates they impose on education, as, for example, the requirements for special education. What about the rest of it? Okay. Okay.